Okay, we'll start on the next chapter in this section of practices and perspectives. The last one was all on the gradual path, and this is titled Sudden Penetration. So it's trying to recognize the immediacy of the Buddha's teaching and the way of practice. And I think one of the things is really important, and I mentioned it yesterday or the day before, it came up in the reading of the habit that we have of getting into an either-or mindset. It's either got to be like this or it's got to be like that. It's either got to be black or it's got to be white, and or it's got to be this or it's got to be that. And you realize, no, in truth and in reality, you can have multiple realities coinciding at the same time, so that having a gradual path that also has the capability of bringing about an immediate understanding and penetration, those can coexist. So you put your attention on the factors and foundations of a gradual training, but there's this necessity of recognizing or realizing that the opportunity is always present for understanding to arise and for things to fall away very, very quickly if we view things in the correct way, practice in the correct way. Because it's embedded in the very definition of description of the Dhamma, sandhittiko. It's apparent here and now. There's a clue. So it's akaliko, it's timeless, not bound by time. We chant it all the time, and it's pointing to a reality that is very immediate. So I think it's important to highlight that it doesn't have to be one or the other, not to box oneself in to one particular camp or viewpoint. Okay, so we'll start the chapter. That was a preamble. The directness of the Buddha's teaching is an aspect that practitioners reflect on regularly. The daily chanting in the Theravada tradition refers to the Dhammas being sandhittiko, apparent here and now, or directly visible, and akaliko, timeless or immediate. In order to utilize truly the legacy of the Buddha's guidance, we need to apply the ways of practice as directly and immediately as we can. Although there are, quote-unquote, 84,000 Dhamma doors, the clear penetration of one door is what leads to Nibbana. We can compare doors or create doors or sand and paint doors, but that doesn't get us through them. So being attentive to what will take us through directly is a necessary part of our practice. In the same way that we can wander aimlessly for a long time along a wilderness path, we can wander along the Buddhist path of practice in a way that is less than efficacious or effective, beneficial, if we are not wisely considering how to implement that path directly and realize its true purpose. So the first quote I have is from Majjhima 10. Majjhima 10 is the Satipatthana Sutta. And the short quote that I give is, "Bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely, the four foundations of mindfulness." And of course, we're all familiar with the four foundations of mindfulness because it's so fundamental to our practice of meditation, development of mindfulness, cultivation of the path. But what I wanted to do is read the full sutta, but try to encourage everybody to listen to it, because the instructions on the four foundations of mindfulness are pretty extensive, and we can really, quite rightly, put a lot of attention into developing that. But sometimes we don't think of it in terms of an immediate practice, an immediate recognition of its potential, of it being the potential of surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, disappearance of pain and grief, attainment of the true way, realization of Nibbana, immediate benefits. So I want to read it to encourage people to try to listen to it from that perspective of that immediacy, or that santitical, of it being apparent here and now. Don't look too analytically at it. Don't try to sort of figure it out too much. And there's some great teachings. And even the Buddha said he could teach on the four foundations of mindfulness for a full 100 years, for a whole lifetime, and not finish. But the purpose isn't to listen to the teachings for a whole lifetime, but to reflect on them and to realize that the fruits of that are being pointed out to us or given to us. So just the opportunity to listen with that kind of perspective. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kamasadhamma. I'll go on a digression here before I get too far. In the commentaries, or in the histories, sort of north of Delhi, the area where there's a new branch monastery of Wat Pa Phong is kind of in that area. As the hills start to rise up, and there's an old, very old pilgrimage site. That area was the area of the Kurus, so it's sort of going back there again. Ajahn Jivaka spent about a year there, and they're putting roots down. And then the sutta goes on, Bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. And again, a sense of this direct path, ekayano mago. There's been various interpretations, but I think this is a very good interpretation of it. It's a path going in one direction only. So it's very direct, leading to the goal. What are the four? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides, contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. And the translation of the body as a body, on feelings as feelings as feelings, and through these four foundations of mindfulness. A useful translation that I have particularly appreciated is Ajahn Jeff's translation, the body in and of itself, feelings in and of itself. It's another angle that is an appropriate translation. He abides contemplating feelings as feelings, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating the body as a body? Here, a bhikkhu, having gone to the forest, or to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and establish mindfulness in front of him. Ever mindful, he breathes in, mindful, he breathes out. Breathing in long, he understands, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formations. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formations. Just as a skilled lathe operator or his apprentice, when making a long turn, understands, I make a long turn. Or when making a short turn, understands, I make a short turn. So too, breathing in long, a bhikkhu understands, I breathe in long, and so on, he trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formations. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body externally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body both internally and externally, or else he abides contemplating in the body its nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of vanishing, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body. This refrain will come up through the whole sutta, in that there is these different bases or foundations for mindfulness, but at the end of each, there is the formula for denoting insight practice or insight knowledge in realization. Again, bhikkhus, when walking, a bhikkhu understands, I am walking. When standing, he understands, I am standing. When sitting, he understands, I am sitting. When lying down, he understands, I am lying down. Or he understands accordingly, however his body is disposed. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body, internally, externally, and both internally and externally, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That, too, is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs, who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body, internally, externally, and both internally and externally. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu reviews this same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, bounded by skin as full of many kinds of impurity thus. In this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends, full of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus, this is hill rice, this is red rice, these are beans, these are peas, this is millet, this is white rice. So too, a bhikkhu reviews this same body as full of many kinds of impurity thus. In this body there are head hairs and through to urine. In this way he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, externally, and both internally and externally. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu reviews this same body, however it is placed, however disposed by way of elements thus. In this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. Just as though a skilled butcher or his apprentice had killed a cow and was seated at the crossroads with it cut up into pieces, so too a bhikkhu reviews this same body by way of elements thus. In this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body, internally, externally, and both internally and externally. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides, contemplating the body as a body. Again, bhikkhus, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, 1, 2, or 3 days dead, bloated, livid, and oozing matter. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body, too, is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, externally, and both internally and externally. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, being devoured by crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, and various kinds of worms, a bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body, too, is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews. A fleshless skeleton smeared with blood held together with sinews. A skeleton without flesh and blood held together with sinews. Disconnected bones scattered in all directions. Here a hand bone, there a foot bone, here a shin bone, there a thigh bone, here a hip bone, there a backbone, here a rib bone, there a breastbone, here an arm bone, there a shoulder bone, here a neck bone, there a jaw bone, here a tooth, there the skull. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. That too is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, bones bleached white, the color of shells, bones heaped up, bones more than a year old, rotted and crumbled to dust. A bhikkhu compares the same body with it thus. This body, too, is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body externally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body internally and externally, or else he abides contemplating in the body its nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of vanishing, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of both arising and vanishing, or else mindfulness that, quote unquote, there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating feelings as feelings? Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, a bhikkhu understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful feeling, he understands, I feel a painful feeling. When feeling a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly painful feeling. When feeling an unworldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly painful feeling. When feeling a worldly neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly neither painful nor pleasant feeling. In this way, he abides contemplating feelings as feelings internally, or he abides contemplating feelings as feelings externally, or he abides contemplating feelings as feelings both internally and externally, or else he abides contemplating in feelings their nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in feelings their nature of vanishing, or he abides contemplating in feelings their nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else mindfulness that there is feeling is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating feelings as feelings. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind as mind? Here a bhikkhu understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust, and mind unaffected by lust as mind unaffected by lust. He understands mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. He understands mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion, and mind unaffected by delusion as mind unaffected by delusion. He understands contracted mind as contracted mind, and distracted mind as distracted mind. He understands exalted mind as exalted mind, and unexalted mind as unexalted mind. He understands surpassed mind as surpassed mind, and unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed mind. He understands concentrated mind as concentrated mind, and unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated mind. He understands liberated mind as liberated mind, and unliberated mind as unliberated mind. In this way, he abides contemplating mind as mind internally, or he abides contemplating mind as mind externally, or he abides contemplating mind as mind both internally and externally, or else he abides contemplating in mind its nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in mind its nature of vanishing, or he abides contemplating in mind its nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else mindfulness that there is mind is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind as mind. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects? So in Pali it is Dhamma. So Dhamma with a small d could also just be, it really means any kind of phenomena, any kind of phenomena. It's like a classification of experience. You're classifying things into certain experiences. Here a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five hindrances. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five hindrances? Here, there being sensual desire in him, a bhikkhu understands there is sensual desire in me. Or there being no sensual desire in him, he understands there is no sensual desire in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. There being ill will in him, there being sloth and torpor in him, there being restlessness and remorse in him, there being doubt in him, a bhikkhu understands there is doubt in me. Or there being no doubt in him, he understands there is no doubt in me. And he understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen doubt, and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen doubt, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned doubt. In this way, he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects internally, or he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects externally. Or he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects both internally and externally. Or else he abides contemplating in mind objects their nature of arising. Or he abides contemplating in mind objects their nature of ceasing, of vanishing. Or he abides contemplating in mind objects their nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else mindfulness that There are mind objects is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five hindrances. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five aggregates affected by clinging. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five aggregates affected by clinging? Here a bhikkhu understands such is material form, such its origin, such its disappearance. Such is feeling, such its origin, such its disappearance. Such is perception, such its origin, such its disappearance. Such are the formations, such their origin, such their disappearance. Such is consciousness, such its origin, such its disappearance. In this way, he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, internally, externally, and both internally and externally. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five aggregates affected by clinging. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the six internal and external bases. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the six internal and external bases? Here a bhikkhu understands the I, he understands forms, and he understands the fetter that arises dependent on both. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen fetter and how there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen fetter. And how there comes to be the future non-arising of the abandoned fetter. He understands the ear, he understands sounds, he understands the nose, he understands odors, he understands the tongue, he understands flavors, he understands the body, he understands tangibles, he understands the mind, he understands mind objects, and he understands the fetter that arises dependent on both. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen fetter, and how there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen fetter, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of the abandoned fetter. In this way, he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects internally, externally, and both internally and externally. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the six internal and external bases. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the seven enlightenment factors? Here, there being the mindfulness enlightenment factor in him, a bhikkhu understands, there is the mindfulness enlightenment factor in me. Or there being no mindfulness enlightenment factor in him, he understands, there is no mindfulness enlightenment factor in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen mindfulness enlightenment factor, and how the arisen mindfulness enlightenment factor comes to fulfillment by development. There being the investigation of states, enlightenment factor in him, Pali is Dhamma Vichaya, so investigation, contemplation, reflection. There being the energy enlightenment factor in him, there being the rapture enlightenment factor in him, there being the tranquility enlightenment factor in him, there being the concentration enlightenment factor in him, there being the equanimity enlightenment factor in him, a bhikkhu understands, there is the equanimity enlightenment factor in me. Or there being no equanimity enlightenment factor in him, he understands, there is no equanimity enlightenment factor in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen equanimity enlightenment factor, and how the arisen equanimity enlightenment factor comes to fulfillment by development. In this way, he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects internally, externally, and both internally and externally. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the Four Noble Truths. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the Four Noble Truths? Here, a bhikkhu understands as it actually is, this is suffering. He understands as it actually is, this is the origin of suffering. He understands as it actually is, this is the cessation of suffering. He understands as it actually is, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. In this way, he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects internally, or he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects externally, or he abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects both internally and externally, or else he abides contemplating in mind objects their nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in mind objects their nature of vanishing, or he abides contemplating in mind objects their nature of both arising and vanishing, or else mindfulness that there are mind objects is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the Four Noble Truths. Bhikkhus, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 7 years, one of two fruits could be expected for him. Either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. Let alone 7 years, bhikkhu, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 6 years, for 5 years, for 4 years, for 3 years, for 2 years, for 1 year, one of two fruits could be expected for him. Either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. Let alone 1 year, bhikkhus, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 7 months, for 6 months, for 5 months, for 4 months, for 3 months, for 2 months, for 1 month, for half a month, one of two fruits could be expected for him, either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. Let alone half a month, bhikkhus, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way, for 7 days, one of two fruits could be expected for him, either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. So it was with reference to this that it was said, bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely, the four foundations of mindfulness. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. I wanted to read it right through to really get the cadence and the feel, because the mind has to take the opportunity. I think it's important. You're not trying to figure out every little bit of the sutta. You're just trying to let whatever lands in a way that piques one's interest or stirs up that sense of reflection and investigation or paying attention. And kind of getting the sense, oh yeah, this is all about being present and mindful and letting go. Part of that formula of the insight is the mindfulness that there are mind objects and body feelings is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is a pointer to what is referred to by the Buddha as atamayata. Ajahn Buddhadasa, the great Thai master, said that's the final word in Buddhism. He really holds it up as something high. And toward the end of his life, he spent a lot of time giving talks and teachings just on atamayata. And it, literally, it means not made of that. But it's usually translated as non-identification, which is subjective, sort of internal, not identifying with anything, or non-fashioning, unconcoctability is sort of an objective way. Either way, it refers primarily to the quality of experience prior to or without a subject-object duality arising. This is a direct experience. And that's what these foundations of mindfulness are. Opening up a doorway into direct experience, taking the opportunity to develop it in that way. And of course, there is a lot, but all you need is paying attention to just one thing really carefully. Ajahn Chah said, like, you don't have to sort of go and study every single tree in a forest. Just, you know, really pay attention to one tree, and because they've all got the similar nature. They've got roots in the ground, they've got a trunk that grows up, they got branches, they got leaves. They're all like that. All of our phenomena that we experience in this body-mind complex is of the same nature. So that just sort of taking something and paying attention and recognizing its tone. The Satipatthana can be expounded on quite fully and quite wonderfully, actually. Like, there's a series of books by Joseph Goldstein, I think three full-length books on talks that he gave on Satipatthana, and it's really fun listening. But in terms of practice, you want to see, how do I bring this down to a point where there is this quality of mindfulness so that one is able to abide independently, not clinging to anything in the world. That's the essence.
I was just thinking about this. I've often interpreted that phrase that you were just talking about in my mind as kind of a description of the not-self perception.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, I was just thinking, well, atamayata, they're not equivalent, but I'm wondering, do you think that the
not-self-perception
is sort of like the direct precursor to the experience of atamayata, or?
No, I don't think you can parse them apart.
Okay.
I don't think
so
you can parse it. Yeah, that understanding of not self, well, actually, penetration of anicca, dukkha, or anatta has that flavor of relinquishment and release and letting go. And so that sense of not clinging to anything in the world. So whatever is the catalyst for that not clinging to anything in the world, it can be described, say, or depicted as atamayata, but not made of that, because there is that non-identification and non-fashioning, because one sees it in a way that one no longer wants to bind oneself to it. Yeah?
I had two questions, actually. One is, when the term unworldly is used, is that referring to non-identification?
Not necessarily, but it would mean something that is a bit more exalted than one's worldly perception. Say like a jhana state, or, you know, just being peaceful, or, you know, delighting in simplicity and renunciation. It's an unworldly, pleasant feeling.
The second question I have is about the phrase, to the extent necessary.
Right. How much? How can I measure it and define it and be sure that I'm doing it right? It has to come down to the response of the heart. How much am I willing to let go? the fruit of it is what's important, right? Because if you keep trying to say, how much samadhi do I need for insight? It's the same sort of question. And there is no answer because there's all, well, more, of course. To the extent necessary is to that which turns the mind. Or we are willing to look in a way that our mind is turned away from the world and to relinquishment and renunciation. Or to release and letting go, being willing to, okay, I'm willing, I'm ready to let go. Yeah.
What does contemplating the body internally and externally mean?
There's all sorts of commentary explanations, but you've got this body here. How do we experience outside of that? So just what are bodies like everywhere? Just sort of paying attention. It can be that simple. Yeah.
A comment on that. Sometimes we have a feeling that there's a person sitting right to me or left to me.
Right, right.
I think that's external, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, like mindfulness and clear comprehension is not just a focused inward. It's all just like really paying attention to the things around you. Also learning from other people, especially with bodies. You know, we're looking at aspects of posture or elements and 32 parts. I remember a friend of mine growing up. He'd always get in fights with his brother because his brother would leave fingernail clippings around. he was just so grossed out by it. But, it's just this external body part. They were pretty close in age, so they'd get into some major fights. And, of course, his older brother was always tormenting him. So that internally, externally, we can use things around us for contemplation, for our own understanding of ourselves. So, other bodies are like that. Oh, that's I'm like that as well. Because in the end, we're not very unique, actually. Like Ajahn Chah would say, oh, same brand. Mi ho dio ga. Okay, so that illustration of this direct path of practice and using it for its true purpose. The first quote was from Satipatthana Sutta. The next quote from the Sutta Nipata. Here, Hemaka, with regard to things that are dear, seen, heard, sensed, and cognized, there is the dispelling of passion and desire, the undying state of Nibbana. Those knowing this, mindful, fully unbound in the here and now, are forever calmed, having crossed over beyond entanglement in the world. A lot of the Sutta Nipata is poetic verse, and some of these verses are really very beautiful. And so the sense of the teaching that he gives to the wanderer Hemaka, with regard to things that are dear, things we're concerned about, we like, we want, we appreciate, whether they're seen, heard, sensed, or cognized, one needs to dispel the passion and desire. There is the dispelling of passion and desire. And within that is the undying state of Nibbana. Nibbana isn't anywhere other than in our experience. And those knowing this, mindful, being aware, being fully present, fully unbound in the here and now, that's the possibility of that. One can be completely liberated in this present moment. They're forever calmed, having crossed over beyond entanglement in the world. It's a very direct equation to the relinquishment and Nibbana and experience. I think I'll leave it there for tonight.